Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today on this encore edition of Midday is the internationally acclaimed writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Last spring, she published her fourth novel, Dream Count. It's her first work of fiction since her masterpiece, Americana, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award 12 years ago. Dream Count is a brilliant rumination on friendship and feminism, a study of what makes relationships work and why they fail. It's about people making assumptions and how those assumptions can advance injustice. It's about contagious dignity and a reflection on what fulfillment means and why it's so elusive. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie was raised in Nigeria. She splits her time between Nigeria and the U.S. She and her family have a home here in Maryland. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. Chimamanda, welcome back. It's such a pleasure to talk to you all the time.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. It's always nice to talk to you.
And I just have to tell you, this book is just beautiful and powerful and different and just wonderful in every way. I was just, you know, sometimes you have a book that you just don't want to have it end. And this is one of those books.
That makes me very happy.
Yeah, but
I think the word that I particularly like that you just said is different.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the structure of it is different, even the rhythm of it and the flow of it. It's just terrific. And so, you know, but damn you for making it end, you know.
Sorry, I tried.
Yeah, right. I actually want to start at the very end. After the book is finished, you write an author's note, which is an interesting story in and of itself, and we'll talk about it in a second perhaps. But in the first line of your author's note, you say, novels are never really about what they're about. And I wonder, in what ways is this novel not about what it's about? Because it's about four incredible women and their lives, but what's it not about?
I think novels, I mean, we kind of know what they're about on the surface, and I think that can be interesting. But often I think there's another surface, another layer that's deeper and that may not be entirely obvious to the reader. So sometimes I read a novel that I love, and sometimes I can tell what, you know, sometimes I'll think to myself, this writer is working out something else that's really not what this novel is about, if that makes sense. I think in my case, I knew I was writing about women. And it wasn't until I reread what I had written when I was close to finishing that I realized that this book is really about losing my mother. It's a book about grief that is not about grief. I don't think it's, I mean, I think there's a lot of melancholy in it, but I don't think it's a grieving book. I don't think it's a sad book, but it came from a place of grief. I was newly in just shock at losing my mother. My father had died, and then months later, my mother died, both unexpectedly, and it really devastated me. And I hadn't been able to write until then. I had a long period in which I just could not write fiction. And after my mother died, I started writing. And again, obviously I knew that I was grieving, but I didn't make that connection. I really didn't consciously think that. And then when I realized how much of the book was about mothers and daughters, I was taken aback by it. And I also just felt, I felt my mother's spirit. I really did.
Well, I think that's actually the last time we talked was right after the book called On Grief, which you wrote about your father and his, as you said, unexpected passing. And then your mom died soon thereafter. And it's the beginning of COVID time, in 2021. Yes. We're sort of right in the thick of it at that point. You have a daughter at that point who's, what, 4 or 5 years old, you
Yes.
know, and all of this swirling around. It must have been hard to get back into a rhythm of writing. I mean, you wrote the grief book was just so moving because you gave voice and you know, you put just the right words to how all of us feel in a universal way when we experience grief. But it's a very personal, vulnerable book. And this, I don't know, do you think there's a vulnerability in this book too, even though it's a novel, it's fiction?
Yes. I have felt since my father died and then my mother, I felt a lot more uncertain. I felt less sure of everything, which I suppose is not that surprising because I just have this feeling now that anything can happen, right? When my father died, and I think this happens with grief, I became really obsessed with a kind of panic and thinking I'm going to lose other people I love will die. And I remember speaking to a therapist who was wonderful and very rational, and she said to me, let's think about this in terms of just statistics. You know, what are the odds? And it made so much sense to me. I thought, yeah, you're right. Nobody's going to die. And then months later, my mother died. And so I think what it did to me was just kind of, in some ways, dismantle the sense of being able to predict the world, you know? And so it's also just made me more, much more vulnerable, but I think also more willing to acknowledge the vulnerability. In some ways, maybe I don't even have a choice. But I do think that this book, and this is why I said I loved that word different, because it does feel very different to me. I think I'm a different person. I think, I think there's just so much about this book that is not like anything I've done before. And I think it's because I have been changed by grief, by life.
And there's so many things you can't control in our lives, but you can control fiction. You control everything. I
Well,
want
actually, to an
to.
extent, no, but this is interesting, though. To an extent, because I mean, I really do think that my characters, they come alive, they take on a life. And it's a life in which I have a certain amount of control, but it's not complete control. So in some ways, I think of it, and this, I cannot help but bring up my Catholic upbringing. I think it's what Catholics mean when they talk about free will. I think when Catholics talk about free will, they're sort of suggesting that God has a certain amount of control, but then that people have room to make their own choices. So I think, well, I think of myself as God. No, I think, but to an extent, I think to write fiction is to play God, but it's also the sort of God that allows room for the characters. So sometimes I think something will happen to a character, and then it doesn't. Right? Sometimes I have a kind of vague plan, and when I start to write, things change in the writing, which, for me has always been the magic of writing fiction, that I don't always know, and that the writing itself becomes a kind of discovery.
And you wrote a bunch of essays, you know, collections of essays. You wrote a children's book. It's not that you haven't been writing at all in the 12 years since Americana, but was it a different endeavor to get back to fiction? You know, what did it feel different in a palpable way than when you were writing Americana?
Yes, absolutely. Fiction has always felt different for me. Fiction, and it's the thing I love. I think so often I'll say writing is my vocation, but actually what I mean is that writing fiction is my vocation. Nonfiction, obviously, I think is very important, but it's just not the same thing. Fiction is magical. Fiction is free in a way. There's a freedom that I find in writing fiction that just doesn't exist anywhere else for me. And I think it's partly because I don't have to protect myself. I don't have to hide. If I were writing a memoir piece, I'm very much aware of the I, the character that is me. And I think, you know, that kind of human need to to practice self-preservation unconsciously kicks in. So even when I'm being honest, I think I'm still thinking that I don't want to expose all my demons. But with fiction, you know, you're in this kind of really just wonderful imaginative space. And I find that I feel myself to be just deeply honest and free. And, you know, again, that idea of just discovering. So that's what I could not do in all those years. And that's what, you know, made me miserable because I could not write fiction. And so yes, absolutely, it's really different. And fiction is also, it's in writing fiction that I also feel a kind of anxiety. So I'm always worried that it's going to go away. And when I'm writing, it's all I want to do, you know. And God bless the people I love, but I just cannot wait to get back to the writing when I'm with the people I love. And sometimes even the thought of going to bed makes me worry because I think I'm going to wake up and this character
It'll
will
be
be gone.
gone. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, her new book is Dream Count. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation's pre-recorded, so we're not able to take calls or comments today. The other thing about fiction, and you and I have talked about this before, is there is a level of truth to it that is very important. And in a way, you've said that fiction is truer than nonfiction. And again, in this author's note to this current novel, you say that when you talk about the point of art, is you say it can't be a gimmick. It has to be at some level really true. And that comes through, I think, on every page of this book, and not just in broad ways of truth. You have a scene where you describe it as you say the house was shrilly quiet. And I just love that because there is a, we all know that kind of quiet that is shrill. That's the last word most people would think to describe quiet with, you know? But there is a truth there that you sort of can't unearth when you're writing nonfiction because the reality gets in the way. Yeah.
Yes, this is
And
what I love the freedom that fiction gives me. I love the freedom of, in some ways, it's that your imagination becomes this, you know, sort of endless space. You know, I think there's something ultimately hopeful about writing fiction, even when it's a sad book.
yeah, and of course, this is not a sad book. This is a very funny book in a lot of ways. And there are wonderful characters. There's four women. So let's talk a little bit about each of these women. The first is Chiamaka.
Yes.
She's a travel writer. What should we know about her?
Oh, she's a Nigerian woman who's now living in the US and who loves living in the US, which I think is important because not all the characters do. She's very privileged. Her family is wealthy. She's not as good a writer as she would like to be. So hasn't found much success in her travel writing, but it's also a question of whether it's because of what she wants to do, which is that she wants to write very light, sort of quirky, funny travel pieces, and the publishers and the editors that she encounters think that she should write sort of serious things about, you know, the suffering in Africa, about which, of course, she knows nothing. And so she you know, the novel starts with COVID. COVID is kind of a backdrop in the novel. So she is alone in her house here in Maryland, and she's looking back at her life. And she's very dreamy. She's not the most practical of people. And she has this very dreamy idea of what love is. And she just refuses to she refuses to give up on that idea. And so she looks back at her relationships. And I think in that way that COVID did for many people, she kind of takes stock of her life, and she wonders, you know, she wonders whether she made mistakes, she deals with regret, but also in the end, she, you know, she's I think for me, the character is a kind of a study in defiant dreaminess.
And her quest for love, her journey in that regard, you describe it so beautifully at one point where you say, where she says, "I wanted love, old-fashioned love. I wanted my dreams afloat with his, to fight and be briefly bereft, always knowing that the sweetness of reconciliation was afoot." I think that's such a great way of describing this tumultuous relationship that she had with that particular character. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the other three very powerful, very wonderful women who are at the center of this new novel. The book is called Dream Count. The author is my guest, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. We will continue our conversation after a quick break. A reminder, our program was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any calls or comments today. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us. Welcome back to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation with the novelist and essayist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her latest book is a sweeping, beautiful chronicle of four women, each remarkable in her own way, and how their intertwined lives enrich and enlighten each other. The book is called Dream Count. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any calls or comments today. So Chimamanda, we talked about Chiamaka, the travel writer from Nigeria, who's living in U.S., in Maryland, and traveling and writing. Let's talk about a friend of hers, a lawyer named Zikora. Tell us the important highlights of her.
Zikora is a lawyer. She lives in Washington, D.C. She is in some ways the most conventional of the women. She has dreams of getting married, having children, you know, having a big Catholic wedding, and she just is surprised that somehow life doesn't give her the things that she imagined that life would give her. And instead, without giving much away, she goes through something difficult. I'm trying not to give things away, but so she she's also a woman of faith, so she's, you know, a very keen Catholic believer, and so she goes through this very difficult relationship, which shocks her. Yeah, I think that's she's interesting because I discovered a character and explored a character who, in some ways, is not like most of the women that I write, which is that I'm often drawn to women who are outside of conventional expectations, but she isn't, and she's also willingly inside of convention, which, you know, which I think is interesting because it's also the reality for many women.
And I don't think I knew this until I read about it, because I had forgotten it if I did know it, but is Zikora a character in another story that you had written earlier?
Yes. So I wrote the story. I mean, she's mostly the same. So I may have changed things about her. But yes, I did write a short story years ago in which she, in which she was the major character, yes.
So that's interesting that she reappears in this novel.
Yes.
And then there's just an amazing character. Well, they're all amazing, but this character of Kadi or Kadiatu, yes, who is not Nigerian, she's Ghanaian. You write, you describe her in one of the early scenes in which she makes an appearance as having contagious dignity. Mm. And I thought that was so moving and so perfect. And she is a character actually based in part on a real life person. What can we tell folks about Kadi?
So Kadi is, Kadi works as a hotel housekeeper in Washington, D.C. She's from Guinea. She has a daughter who she's raising in the U.S. And she just is so grateful for America. She just loves, you know, the opportunity that America represents. And then she is she's assaulted by a hotel guest, and then we kind of follow her. We sort of see what happens after that. But she's very loosely inspired. Well, actually, not loosely inspired. She is inspired by a woman called Mafisato Jello, who some years ago accused Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who at the time was the chief of the IMF, of sexual assault. And of course, the small details are different. So the Dominique Strauss-Kahn incident happened in New York. But when I first learned about the incident with Nafisato Jello and Dominique Strauss-Kahn, I was very moved by it. I was very interested in it because I felt a connection to this woman who, in many ways, is not like me, but still I felt a kind of sisterly protectiveness. She's also West African. And I also just was very moved by what I thought was her powerlessness. She's not a native English speaker. She's just a hotel housekeeper. She's not very sophisticated in the Western way. And her case was dropped because it was said that she had lied on her asylum application. And I remember just feeling so upset by this because I thought, you're not saying she's lied about what happened in the hotel. You're saying she's lied about something that happened years before and which had nothing to do with the case. And it just really, I felt actually not just upset, I was enraged. And I remember exactly when I heard the news that the case had been dropped. But I didn't plan to write a character based on her. And so when I started writing this novel and this character kind of came alive, I realized that I must have been carrying the rage and the disappointment that I felt on her behalf, on Nafisato Jello's behalf. I must have been carrying it all these years. And so it came out in this character. But most of all, what wounded me the most was I felt that she had been denied of her human dignity, that this woman, in the way that she was covered in the press, in the way that her story was told, that she wasn't allowed just the basic human dignity. And that broke my heart. And for me, writing this character was a way of creating a woman who could be Nafisato Jello. And I think a way of reminding myself that it's so important to remember that people are human, even though that kind of sounds obvious, but that she's a person with dreams and that she's a person who loves and that she's a person who's been loved and that the sexual assault is not her only story.
Yeah, and of course, that story took place a long time ago. I mean, the Dominique Strauss-Kahn incident, the assault, this predator, was 2011,
Yes.
and and Nafisato Jallo did the criminal charges were dropped against Dominique Strauss-Kahn. I guess she did get a financial settlement of some sort, and as I understand it, she's opened a restaurant in the Bronx. But it was just so horribly unfair and so horribly unjust.
Yes.
And you said that creating her, and again, this is in this afterword, the author's note, creating her was a gesture of returned dignity. And I thought that's just a wonderful thing that an artist can do. You
Yeah.
have that power, you know.
Stories have, yes, I think stories have the power of reminding us, that people have dignity, that people deserve dignity.
Yeah. And of course, she has this wonderful relationship with her daughter, Binta. And you write when, well, Chia says of Kadi that sometimes, rarely, you meet a person who blends into your life as if the designers of destiny had long made room for her. And I thought, boy, what a blessing to have a friend like that. What a great, sacred honor it is, to be able to
Yes.
be that close to someone and to, but you talk about, and it's her relationship with her daughter and her relationship with these other women. I want to talk about the fourth woman, whose name I may be mispronouncing. Omlagor, is that how you say it?
Impressed because I have to tell you, it's such an unusual name that even Nigerians cannot pronounce it. And because I take much joy in making things difficult for people, I thought I would use it. But it's a no, I find it a beautiful name, and it means one who does beautiful things, sort of. But she's Chiamaka's cousin, and she lives in Nigeria. She lives in Abuja, which is Nigeria's capital, and she's a banker, and she has allowed herself to become part of a very corrupt system of banking, and she becomes very wealthy. But also, she steals stolen money, and she gives it out to women who want to start small businesses. But also, she at some point feels that she, I guess, a certain kind of regret, or she just feels that she's had it with the corruption, and she wants to in some ways cleanse herself. And in her mind, one of the ways to do that is to come to America and go back to graduate school, because she imagines America as, this wondrous place where one is bound to find something that's better than one, something to look up to. And so she comes, and she wants to study, of all things, the pornography industry, because she feels
Which is
very
really
strongly.
something. And she even has a little column she writes, Dear Men.
She has a column in which she writes little advice bits for men and their relationships, and it's sort of half sarcastic, but also she really does kind of think that it might help men. So she ends each of her blog posts with the words, "Remember, dear men, I am on your side." But when she comes to America, it's not quite what she imagined it would be, and so I think there's a portrait of American academia that is maybe less than flattering, but
Yes.
she does not, so she just does not do well in the US. She does not do well in graduate school, because she's just shocked at sort of how unfree it is. So she thought it would be a place in which she could discover and grow, but actually she realizes she can't even ask basic questions, and that people have sort of preconceived ideas about who she is and how she should be and all of those things. And so she doesn't do well, she gets very depressed, and she leaves and goes back to Nigeria.
Yeah, and your critique of academia, your critique of the American left, I think is not only spot on, but very intriguing and just trenchant. At one point, she's Omnigor's in a class, and they're talking, and these people who are very much left of center are offended by one thing or another. And you write, it wasn't even that they felt offended, it was that offended was the only thing they felt. Perfect, righteous American liberals, as long as you board their ideology train, your evilness will be overlooked. If you champion an approved cause, you win the right to be cruel. That's going right after them. And I suppose you could say that on the right and the left and all the, but that is really, it's quite a critique, yeah.
It is, but it's also, and I suppose one could say that of the political right, but that is not the, I'm not interested in the political right. It's just not, I'm interested in my tribe, and I'm left leaning. And I feel very strongly that the basic ideas on the left, I think, are just better ideas for organizing society. This sort of, belief that we can thrive in a diverse society, that, there should be some sort of safety net for people, that, we should think about people being able to live on their wages, things like that, I think. I just think it's a better way of organizing society. But I also think that the way that the American left has evolved in the past maybe 10, 15 years almost doesn't feel like it's aligned to those fundamental ideas of what it means to be on the left. And so yes, it is, it is, but again, I think it's interesting thinking about it from the point of view of a person who isn't, who knows America but doesn't really know America. And so at some point, Omologo says that America makes more sense when you're looking in from outside, Because it's not until she gets into it that she starts to think, well, maybe this isn't quite as it's portrayed in the Hollywood films, you know, where good and justice always sort of triumphs. But also, you know, she's interested, and I am obviously as the author, because I mostly agree with her on her views of American academia, of that idea of sort of being expected to bend to ideological conformity, even if that's not your story. So she is telling a story about her uncle. So Nigeria is, well, half of Nigeria is Christian, the other half is Muslim. And she is telling a story about a beloved uncle who was killed by Muslim fanatics. And she tells the story in her class in graduate school in the US. And everybody in her class, you know, she's shocked at how they are unable to feel any compassion, but instead they accuse her of being Islamophobic. And she is just stunned because, you know, because in her mind, and again, it's that idea that there's room only for one feeling, for one interpretation, for one response. And it just feels so it just feels so opposed to everything that liberalism is supposed to be.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the new book is called Dream Count. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the differences and the critiques you make both of Nigeria and of America in this just wonderful, wonderful novel. We'll have more on the other side of a quick break. Again, our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any new calls or online comments. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the acclaimed award-winning author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She has written several books of essays, including We Should All Be Feminists, based on her very popular TED Talk that she delivered back in 2012. Another essay collection, Dear Ijeowela, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions, was published in 2017. Her Notes on Grief, published in 2021, is a searing and heart-wrenching contemplation about her pain in the wake of her father's unexpected passing. Her grief was compounded immeasurably when her mother died on her father's birthday, just a few months after that book came out. Her latest book is her fourth novel. It's called Dream Count. It's about how four women nurture and support each other. Takes place during the COVID pandemic in locales that span the globe. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie joined me on Zoom from her home in Colombia. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. So again, Chimamanda, coming back to this, these critiques that you give of Nigeria and America, I was intrigued that at one point, one of the characters notes the knowing laughter, the kind to be laughed only among Africans. And as a person who switches back and forth, because you spend some of your time in Nigeria, some of your time in the States, there are really some really stark differences, and you are making a real effort, it seems, to etch them out in this book.
Yes, I mean that. I'm amused that you notice that, but it's that idea of you know, when you're a member of a community, there is a kind of permission to laugh at yourself, right? So, but only among the members of the community. So, I've always been kind of amused by how angry Nigerians get when a foreigner says something about Nigeria, which often is the same thing that we Nigerians say about Nigeria. But a foreigner says it and we all go crazy with rage. I mean, I'm guilty of this, right? So someone will say something about Nigeria and I get really annoyed. But then I'll turn around and say exactly the same thing to, you know, my friends and my family. And I think it's you know, that kind of in-group sort of sense of community and wanting to protect what you love. And also, I think it comes from knowing that you know that your community is not just about the bad things in it. And sometimes you worry that the foreigner doesn't know that. And so that you worry about that sort of whatever the bad thing is becoming the single story of where you come from. But I've always felt that in writing fiction that one has to be very clear-eyed and honest, right? You have to put aside you have to put aside, in some ways, you have to put aside your love. So the things that I love about Nigeria and the things I love about America, I want to put aside and I want to see. I want to see very clearly. And I don't want to romanticize. That's always been important to me because I think I think that to romanticize something is to be, to be dishonest about it. And so there is a lot that is less than complimentary about both countries, but it's also that those are, I know America well, at least I know some parts of America well, and I know some parts of Nigeria well. And because my life is divided between both, I like to think that I see both very clearly. That when I'm in Nigeria, I see America very clearly. And that when I'm here in the US looking, sort of looking back at Nigeria, I see it really clearly.
Yeah, and it's wonderful and enlightening and fascinating to, in this novel, see how Nigerians consider and confront and understand America and vice versa. At one point, one of the Nigerian characters, Omologor, I think, says, "I never knew there existed in this world a class of people who feel so securely entitled to the minds of other people." Which is this American instinct for saying we have it right and everybody else should do it our way. This notion of exceptionalism. And it's just how shocking that is to a person sitting in a graduate school class, in New York. Talk about motherhood and how the theme of motherhood, the love of a mother to her children, permeates this book. There are a lot of relationships in this book. There's a million men that are, that make an appearance. Children are a central feature of people's aspirations in this book, to a certain extent, right?
I think that's right. And it's the longing for children, but it's also the expectation that one should long for children. And so, Nigerian, many cultures in Nigeria, and I would actually say many cultures across sub-Saharan Africa really feel very strongly about this idea that marriage is not so much about your spouse or love. It's really about child rearing. The whole point of marriage in many traditional cultures across the continent is to have children. And so there's a, the character Chiamaka kind of is musing with some amusement about how when she was younger, she was under a lot of pressure to get married to exactly the kind of man that her mother and her aunts wanted. They wanted an Igbo man, the same ethnic group. They wanted a Catholic. They wanted a man who was very well educated. But as she gets older, at some point they say to her, just a man will do, from wherever, for just a man. And then when she's still not married, they then say to her, well, you should just have a baby. And she's kind of amused by this because she's thinking, well, maybe you could have let me know this was an option, 10 years ago. But it's, obviously as a mother, I've become increasingly interested in motherhood and what it means and what it does to you as a person. I've thought of motherhood and I've experienced motherhood as the greatest gift of my life, but also as something that has asked a lot of me and of my creativity and obviously of my time, right? Which means that there's so much I think that, well, this is my, I think maybe I could have written two more novels if I didn't have my daughter. But I also think that motherhood feeds into one's creativity, that motherhood opens a kind of a new plane of feeling and of perception that I think feeds fiction. I think it's fed mine. And there are different kinds of mother-child relationships in the novel, but it also felt to me that I was working through my sense of just not grief, but of regret. Because after my mother died, one of the most painful things for me was realizing that I had very often taken her for granted.
Sure. We
And
all do. Yeah, every one of us. Yeah.
it's such a painful it's such a painful place to be. And I'm still in that place of just feeling such regret about the stupid little things that I did and shouldn't have. And you just think, my God, you just wasted time. And it's not from a place of it's not from a place of discord, because my mother and I were very close and adored each other. But it's just those small acts that in that in that mean that we take the people we love for granted. And I think that maybe the reason that I have these different forms of mother-child relationships is that it's also my unconscious way of, I don't know, atonement.
Yeah, sure. And of course, you have to be careful not to beat yourself up too much about it because, after a while that's counterproductive. But you, but it, but we all have done it. I mean, gosh, we all have done it. And right
Do
at
you know
the
how happy that makes me just hearing you say we
well,
all do
I mean, I'm very blessed. My mom is 93 years old and I can call her and
Wow.
talk to her every day. She lives in Atlanta.
Wow.
And
Wow.
it's an incredible blessing, it
Yes.
just is.
Yes.
And
Yes, it
but it's not
is.
one that I recognized when I was in my 30s,
Yes.
I just
Yes.
didn't.
Yeah.
But at the very beginning of the book, Chia asks the question, what is the final measure for making the most of life, and how would I know if I have? And that's, of course, a central question. And children, I think, help us answer that question. At least, I don't know, for me, and since this book's come out, I mean, you have babies who are less than a year old, you have little twin boys, in addition to your beautiful daughter. So, is it a matter of a deeper, a better understanding of the human condition because you're raising these babies, or how? What adjective would you, you're the writer, come up with the right adjective for
Oh, I
that
think that works.
experience.
No, I think that works perfectly. I think sometimes the simpler that is, it is true. It's a deeper understanding. It's more. It's more layers. It's more depth. It's more complexity, and maybe in some ways also more contradiction, because it's not a simple thing, I don't think. Just feeling this enormous sense of responsibility for another human being and loving another human being as much as one loves oneself, it's a very strange thing. And it's also quite irrational, really. I mean, when I
Yeah.
really sit back and think about it, I'm thinking, wait, who are these people living in my house?
The permanent guests.
And who are these people for whom I'm willing to change everything? Who are they, right? But yes, I really do think I think I agree that, I mean, obviously for some people this is not the case, but for me it has been the case that being a mother has just brought to me a fuller sense of meaning.
I read that after the babies were born, the twins, you even experienced some writer's block, which had never really been an issue with you before. It's just it's so I mean you're not you're, you know, you lack sleep, your whole life is turned upside down when these babies and that's just what happens when one baby comes or when you have two of them at the same time. I can't imagine that. But how did you work out of that? How did you get back into a rhythm of writing when that, tornado came through initially?
I just had to wait and hope, and I read a lot of poetry, and you just this is the thing about this horrible block is that it brings a kind of helplessness. You do not know when it will pass. You don't know when the creativity will come back. But I think just on a more practical level, having help was very good. I mean, I think one of the best choices I made was who I chose as the father of these children of mine. And
Yeah,
so,
that matters. Absolutely.
so he's very present. And so at some point, because I was, very keen to get back to writing and finish the book, we agreed that I would no longer do what we called night duty, which we would alternate so that because at the time the boys were not sleeping through the night at all, and so my husband decided, I'm going to do all the night duty, and so that helped a bit. And then my cousin came and she was wonderful in helping out, and now we have a wonderful nanny, so.
Well, in the book, there are many relationships that we learn about from all of the characters. There's one in particular that Chia gets very close to, a guy named Chuka. And you describe him so beautifully. He's a successful, accomplished, handsome guy. He checks all the boxes for Chia's mother and father. And you say of him, you noticed him. He subdued space. And I love that. And but she ultimately, it's not necessarily the case that just because there's something that seems perfect, ends up perfectly.
Yes,
And it's
we don't always want what we want to want.
And you've written a children's book, as a matter of fact,
Yes.
Mama's Sleeping Scarf. You wrote that a couple of years ago. Clearly, had something to do with having some babies,
Actually, I wrote that book because I was so terrified that my daughter was not interested in reading. And so I wrote that book, but by the time the book was published, it was too babyish for her. I'm happy to report that she now does some reading, but I was just horrified that she wasn't exactly like me. I started reading, and I loved reading from, I don't know, the age of 4 or something. And this child just, didn't show much of an interest. And so I went into a mild panic.
I am so glad to hear you say that because my wife and I had the same conversation when our daughter was 3 or 4. And or 5 or 6 even. She was not a big super reader when she was a little kid. She's now a playwright and a television screenwriter. All she does
Wow.
is read and write. So
But you don't have any sort of, you don't have any secret recipes for how she ended up actually loving
just
reading?
leave her alone. Leave her alone and she'll be fine. And all of a sudden she will never get her head out of a book. I can almost promise it. That's my prediction. And at some point, she will be old enough to read this beautiful, beautiful book. It's called Dream Count, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It is a fantastic work of art, and it's a delight to talk to you as always. And it was a delight to experience reading this book. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
That's it for us today. You can hear Midday on Demand when you subscribe to the Midday Podcast, available on the WYPR app and wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find all of our shows on the Midday webpage at WYPR.org. Thanks for joining us here on Midday today and every day. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.